Thank you very much, and thank everyone for coming out today. I have to say it's an honor for me to be able to sit on the star, since you described being described as a rock star.
Yeah.
And David, as you were walking by that drum set, I kind of got the feeling that, you said, it looks like the Rolling Stones or something. You play the drums? I mean, is that something that, another talent?
Yeah, anybody can play the drums badly. So my son can play the drums. My kids are very musical. They got that from their mother, from my wife, their mother. And I have to tell you that I'm never going to tell my wife that I was described as a rock star. Let me just say that right away, because you would never see me again, actually.
Well, we have this on video, so you can show it to her a little bit later.
But
have you ever been to Central Pennsylvania?
I have, yeah. I've been all over the states over the course of the last 25 years and been through Pennsylvania and all the adjoining states, Midwest, West Coast, Northeast, South, and all that. I've said a couple of books have been around Central Pennsylvania. I like the isolation here. You know, isolation is great for thriller writers because things can happen.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful countryside. I was remarking earlier that it reminds me, the topography here reminds me a lot of the Virginia Shenandoah Valley with all the farms and beautiful rolling land. This is an absolutely beautiful part of the country here.
Okay, I did have a reason for asking that.
It wasn't just
a tourist pitch or anything like that. You have said, I've read quotes where you say that you get your ideas or you're inspired for your characters or your stories, your books, by looking out your window. We'll talk a little bit about that. What's outside your window? That must be a hell of a thing, I gotta say that. But anyway, when you're doing events like this, you ever get inspiration for a story or a character from people you meet on the road?
I already have today.
Really?
Yeah, it's been great. It's a local newscaster who has won a bunch of awards in Central Pennsylvania will figure prominently in my next novel.
I have to admit that was my goal today. Overall,
we can all go home now. It'll be it's all
that's
done.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, I do get inspiration from places I've been, people that I see in my office. My office is in Fairfax County, Virginia, in Ruston, Virginia. So if, literally to look out my window, if I look out this window, it's Homeland Security office here. If I look out this window, it's National Geospatial. If I look out this window, it's a secure Lockheed Martin facility over here. And so I normally keep my blinds closed because I also know they're watching me.
Well, I can see how that would be inspiration for a lot of the topics that you cover in your books. Do you have ideas for your stories going in, or do they come to you?
I think it's probably a combination of things. When I don't outline everything in the book. I'm working on a couple of multiple books right now, and I have no idea how they're going to end. I'm sort of muddling my way through the plots and all that. I have a lot of really, you know, good friends who are bestsellers, John Grisham, a bunch of others. He and I, every time we appear together, we always have this battle. He's an outliner. I'm not really an outliner. I like to sort of go by the seat of my pants and let things how it's fall through when I'm working through the novel. The characters, I start with characters, and the plots sort of come to me, the outlines, and what the characters speak to me and tell me what I should do with them eventually. I think that's always a good sign. My rule of thumb is, if you want to outline as a writer, outline. If you don't. Do what's comfortable for you. I've always felt like if you want to learn how to drive a Formula One car, there are a couple of ways to do it. You can read a book or go to a class that tells you how to do it, or you can get into a Formula One car and drive it and see how it feels. And so when you're writing a novel, not from an outline, you're almost in the moment, you're in the trenches, you're immersed in this world, and everything takes on a heightened sense of urgency that you don't really get in an outline. You know, what am I supposed to do? You know, a year before you write the book, okay, this is what the character's going to do this day, and this is what they're going to do next, this is what they're going to talk to. There's not a sense of urgency. When you're actually writing the novel, there is that feel of like, I'm in the battle trenches, and things are happening to this character. He's two steps away from being killed, it makes your synapses fire a lot better. At least it does for me. So that's the approach that I take. So the ideas come to me as I'm researching. My books require a lot of research, so I go out and talk to people. I go and visit places and see the topography for myself. I don't like having a buffer in between. I was a trial lawyer for 10 years in Washington, D.C., and I have to tell you, my expectation was that everybody was going to lie to me, including my own clients. So actually seeing them face to face, body language can tell you a lot. I learned years ago, you know, in some of the cop shows, they'd sell, you know, if somebody looks to their right and leans down, they're lying. No, it's about the number of words they use that's really the tell for people. People who are lying will say far fewer words because they're afraid of getting tripped up. They're not telling you what they know, they're telling you what they've made up. So people who are not lying just flourish. They just talk, because they know everything they say is true. They're not worried about it getting tripped up. So if you're talking to somebody and they don't say much to you, they're lying. Okay, that's all I'm saying.
See, now I was always taught, make my questions short. Now I may have to rethink that a little bit. So I get the sense that there are real people in your life that you have modeled characters after.
Yeah, I really have done that. I've never taken a person from whole cloth and put them into a novel. I don't think that would be fair. But I've taken bits and pieces of personality, a physical, sort of physical element, a swagger, a certain way of speaking, you know, that I've taken and grafted onto characters. I remember one of my old law partners years ago, we practiced law together, trial lawyer, wonderful trial lawyer. I learned a lot from him. I remember with my first book that had a lot of lawyers in it, Absolute Power, he came to me and said, okay, which one am I? And I didn't want to hurt his feelings, even though he could be really arrogant. So I just said, you were the really bad one. He goes, I knew it. So,
you know, and these questions are very similar when we're talking about the inspiration of that kind of thing. But you mentioned working as an attorney for 9 years. When you started writing, I understand you started writing at night as kind of a hobby. But did you tap those memories that you had had for 9 years or the time before? Or did you, again, just go in with open eyes and say, here's something I'd like to write about?
Yeah, it was kind of it crossed the spectrum of what you just described. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and I was a sort of kid who was, I planned all the adventures for the neighborhood, you know, all the wars and the battles and the adventures that we'd have and out in the woods and on our mini bikes and all that. So the summers and the evenings were sort of, that's where I got to use my imagination. And I was also one of those kids who never shut up, basically. I talked all the time. I was arguing with people all the time, such that they started calling me, because I grew up on Austin Avenue, they started calling me the Austin Avenue lawyer. At age 6 years old, and I grew up to be a lawyer, it was very prophetic on their part. And so one day, my mom brought me a journal, a blank page book, and said, honey, you know, you've been talking all this stuff nonstop for, you know, like a long time now, so why don't you try writing some of it down? You love to read. Why don't you try writing something that somebody else could read one day? So I put the pen to paper, and it's like this epiphany. I was like, oh my God, I could actually do this. I could write stories down. And I never looked back. You know, I started writing short stories and then screenplays and novellas and eventually novels during the course of my career. And I remember going back to my mom years later after I'd been published, and I said, Mom, my God, you changed my life with that one act. You know, what a gift you gave to me that day. And my mom said, you know, honey, I am so glad it's worked out for you, but quite frankly, I just wanted to shut you the hell up. You know, as they say in the South, she said, honey, you've just gotten on my last nerve, boy. And I just need a little peace and quiet. But out of a small axe come large things.
So were you born creative?
I think in many respects, I had to be creative as a kid. I usually got into trouble with lots of authority figures. You know, school people, not very, very occasionally police officers, but where you had to kind of think fast. And I actually did use that attribute years later. As a trial lawyer, you really have to think fast. You can prepare as much as you want for a trial, but I can just tell you my experience is that you will always be surprised by something because you can't think of everything. And so thinking fast on your feet, I've always looked upon as a real strength. And sometimes even when I'm writing, it's like I'm thinking in my feet because I'm writing a part of the story a certain way and I think it's going to go that way. And I just do a complete 180 and go the other way because of my intuition and my gut tells me this is the right thing to do, not follow what I thought was going to be. And I also try to get out of my comfort zone a lot. I write a lot of different types of books. You know, I'm the only thriller writer in the world who's had two Hallmark movies made of their books. I mean, it's kind of crazy. I've written kids' books for Scholastic, you know, so it's been quite a career. But I just think you need to get out of your comfort zone. And people tend to build up habits of what they do every day. So if they go to the office, they have their coffee and they have their files and they have their work and they go through the work day. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But I'm saying if every once in a while you blow that whole routine up, just let me tell you, I think it's a very positive thing. Because old habits, sometimes you get into complacency, you get dispirited, you lose kind of energy because it's the same thing every day. Nobody wants to be that hamster on the hamster wheel. Hamsters don't have the brains we have. They don't mind being on the hamster wheel, but we do. So I tend to blow up everything I do like every 3 or 4 years and just approach it a whole different way, and it really has worked for me.
Is that why you have certain characters that are in series, for example?
It is very much so. My first 11 to 12 books were all standalone. And then I wrote Split Second, which was the first King and Maxwell series. And at the end of that book, I had not planned it as a series, but I thought at the end of the book, I was like, boy, I haven't even scratched the surface with these two. I have a lot more I could do with them. I've always looked at standalone books as being like a two-hour movie. You know, it's one and done. You watch it, and that's all you're ever going to see of those characters, which is fine. But as a writer, for me to be able to revisit Amos Decker or King and Maxwell or Atlee Pine or Will Robey over and over again, it allows me multiple chances to keep developing and evolving their characters in that arc, which for me is really special as a writer. And also, I like these people. Even though they're not real, they're very real to me. So being away from them for a long period of time is kind of disheartening. So knowing that I'm going to have them back in my life at some point is a cool thing.
You know, parents say often, and I think they mean it most anyway, that they never have a favorite child. I'm sure you've been asked this question, but do you have a favorite character?
Yeah. I also, depending on the day, I also have a favorite child. Just let me just put that out there, because I think every parent here can say that, and it changes. I tend to, it's like whatever book I'm working on is sort of my favorite child at that point, because that's the one I'm heavily invested in at the moment. I like different things. So I started a few years ago this series with Aloysius Archer in the 1940s as my private eye. And that book came about, talk about just reacting to your environment. I was in Toronto, Canada, on book tour in the middle of a snowstorm, and I had just finished all my work and publicity for the day. I was back in my hotel room. It was like 9 o'clock. I don't sleep well on the road. I just never have. And I'm looking out at this wall of white in the middle of Canada, and I thought, Aloysius Archer, I'm going to write a gumshoe detective short story set in 1949. And I just sat down in my hotel room and started it that night. And 2 months later, I had a novel, 400-page novel called One Good Deed, because I was so into that world. My two favorite movies of all time are Chinatown and The Big Sleep. Just, you know, time periods that I really love, evocative, atmospheric, provocative, everything else. I have to admit, I tried to get my son to watch The Big Sleep. This is Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall one time. And I said, this is one of the classic movies of all time. So he's watching it, and after 5 minutes, he's like, this is disgusting, Dad. All these women fawning over him, he's not even attractive. And he calls them baby doll and sugar and stuff. He goes, this is disgusting. And I said, son, I am so proud of you. But if you just give it a little bit more time, it's actually a really good story and a really good movie. But it's just a different time period. And so obviously, you know, you have some things that we would never do or say today. But so wherever I am, and that's my point, is that wherever I am, stories, opportunities are possible everywhere. So Archer is, I'm just beginning a series. I just finished the third one. It'll be out next year. It's called Dreamtown. It's now 1953. He's a private eye in Los Angeles at the height of sort of the golden age of Hollywood. That one has really intrigued me. So I guess if I had to say I had a favorite character, it would be Archer. Amos Decker, close second. Before anybody asked, Camel Club is still out there, is one of my favorite ensembles too.
Well, Mercy.
Yes.
And by the way, the timing on this couldn't have been more perfect here in Lancaster County with the book just published yesterday, just coming out yesterday. Is this the first opportunity you've had to speak publicly about it?
This is only the second public appearance I've made in 2 years.
Really?
Because of COVID.
Well, wanted to bring up Mercy and Atlee Hall. I wanted you to give an example of how a character transitions or grows, or first of all, how did you come up with the idea for Atlee Hall? And then moving along, did you know way back when that after three books, this was going to be where she found her sister Mercy?
Yeah. No, I'm not that smart, so I did not. I did not know it at that point. My wife and I, another couple, a few years ago, we flew out to the Arizona, to Sedona, and we went up to the Grand Canyon. And I had seen the Grand Canyon many times, flying over it, you know, from east to west. And one time I was on a flight going to California, and the pilot gets on about 4 hours in, and this is coming from Virginia, and he says something you never want a pilot to hear. He says, "I have a surprise for you." As everybody's like, click. And he said, "I am the best pilot in the world. I have gotten you to the West Coast an hour and 10 minutes early. Unfortunately, LAX does not have a gate for us. So I have gotten permission to drop down to 5,000 feet. I'm going to take you on a tour of the Grand Canyon." So we dropped down and 5,000 feet, and he obviously knew the Grand Canyon well. So it was so funny. I'm not sure this was even before 9/11. So people were getting up and like going over to this side so they could see, and then he would bank and they would go over to this side and to see. And I was, so then we went out and saw it in person, the Grand Canyon in person. And then we had a guide that was taking us through, and he knew the area and the history incredibly well. So I kept peppering him with questions because I was really intrigued, because once you see the Grand Canyon, first of all, you can't see all of it at any one time. It's too big. And there's no human being on earth that's seen all of the Grand Canyon. That's how enormous it is. And on the drive back, my wife and our friends are in the back. I'm next to the driver. I'm still asking questions. He's still talking. And my wife starts kicking the back of my seat. And later she told me it was because we were tired. I just wanted you two to shut up. Stop asking him questions, you know, because he's talking. So I got back home, and I had thought long and hard about having a female character lead a series. I'd never done that before. I have lots of female characters in all my books. And I have to tell you, I'll just tell you flat out, I have never written about a damsel in distress in my life for one reason. I've never met one in my life. Ever, you know? And with Michelle Maxwell from King and Maxwell, I had written about her being a member of WIFL. And WIFL is a real organization. It's an acronym standing for Women in Federal Law Enforcement. And I got a call from the head of WIFL, and they said, "You're the only author who's ever written about WIFL in one of the books. Would you love to come and be our keynote speaker for our annual convention?" So I went and did it. It was me. It was 500 women. They all had guns. You know, I've never been that intimidated in my whole life. So I really wanted to have a character like Atlee Pine, who was leading a series, was the lead protagonist, not a sidekick or a partner with anyone. She was going to be an FBI agent. She's going to be in the hinterlands of the Grand Canyon, which was isolated, and was aloof, and she was aloof. And this idea of having this traumatic experience in her life where her twin was taken from her. Now, I have to tell you that I did this very literally. The first book, I knew it was going to be multiple books. I didn't know it was going to be four, but it ended up being four. So the first novel, I was being very literal. The long road to Mercy. It was not going to be a short trip. And the fourth book is entitled Mercy, because now we have gotten to Mercy. And it was a different for me. I've written lots of series. I've never written a story where the actual underlying main plot lives for four books. You know, you really have to take a lot of time with that, because you have to make sure that everything is consistent all the way through. You know, when you're on a film set, they have a script supervisor, And we call the person the consistent person, the continuity person. So everything, you might shoot a scene in six strips. So you go to the wardrobe section and you'll see on one costume, six different strips, six different days. This is the person who has to wear this exact same outfit in each one of these scenes, and it has to be totally the same. If it's a tie, it has to be the same tie, shirt, pants, socks, shoes, same hairdo, same hat, same makeup, to make sure it's all consistent. And when you're writing a book series like that, you have to do the same thing. I have to be my own continuity person.
You know, it seems as though the American public, and I'm thinking about television series, movies, and books, that we have a lot of anti-heroes today. And I'm thinking about Al, Mercy, and also Atlee, that they're likable, you're rooting for them, but at the same time, you could see some people not liking them. How do you create that balance?
Yeah, I think it's good because I don't know anyone in my life really that I totally love 100% all of the time. I mean, I don't think human beings are set for that. People upset us, make us mad. Nobody's perfect about that. And I also like to create protagonists and antagonists who will pull from you different emotions, one that will even surprise you. I can write somebody who's really bad, but one of my goals when I do that is to allow that person to do something in that book that will make you second guess your opinion of them. I'm like, because outside of somebody like Ted Bundy, who just had a chromosome problem, he was missing a few vital ones, and serial killers like that, no one is 100% bad. People can do bad things for lots of different reasons. Human beings can rationalize any behavior. You can do an act, it may be really bad, but in your mind, you can rationalize why you did it. That's just the way we're built, a sort of self-preservation sort of thing. So when I build these characters, I want to pull, if it's a good character, I want to make that character do something that's going to piss you off, make you upset and mad, because you didn't expect that from them. And a bad character who does something good, which might piss you off too, because you didn't expect that. You want to put people in boxes. Even in life, we do that. You know, I know this person, I put them in the safe box over here. I know this person, I put them in this box over there. I don't have to think about them anymore because that's who they are, and I know that. It's totally consistent. But life is not like that. People throw you curves all the time, and that's why we get surprised a lot in life. You ever heard the phrase, I thought I really knew that person, you know? And I come to find out I didn't know that person at all. Well, I can work both ways. So when I write novels, I'm trying to imitate real life, so I have to do what life actually does too.
You know, you talked about the number of books you've written. I mean, you didn't give an actual number, but it's over 40. But the different genres of books, number of series, books that stand on their own, even books for young adults. I mean, you truly are prolific. And almost all these books have been bestsellers. Quick question. Which one, is there one that was the hardest to write or took you the longest amount of time to write?
I messed up with a book years ago. It was a book called Last Man Standing. And it was about Webb London, who was an FBI hostage rescue team member. He was a sniper on that. And I wrote that book. It was a long book, 150,000 words. And I was writing it at the same time where I was distracted by something happening in our extended family that was really traumatic for a lot of people. And I had to get involved, not just because who I am, but I was a lawyer, so it was, and it involved some legal issues and principles and things too. So I really was distracted. So I was, at the same time, I was really upset and mad, and into that, I'm writing this novel. So I sent it up to everybody in New York, and they read it, and they were like, wow, this is just not you. You know, this is weird. What's going on? And everybody said the same thing. So I took the manuscript, and I remember this to this day. It was 2001. And I took the manuscript to my office, and I cut 140,000 words in one day out of the novel. I only had 10,000 words left. And that book was due in, 2 months. So I focused, got my head straight, believed in the story that I had wanted to write but didn't in the first attempt, and in 2 months I wrote another 130,000 words. And that book was published and got some of the best reviews I've ever gotten. But that was a lesson to me, that books are really difficult to write. Even writing a bad book is hard. I mean, it's a lot of work, you know? And it, go home today and write 150,000 words. I mean, it's just, it's not easy to do that. But if you're not in the right mindset, you're not going to produce the sort of work that you can be proud of. People ask me, so what, you know, where do you write? Do you have this special place to write? And I said, I have only one special place to write, and it's the only perfect place to write. There is no other perfect place to write. And that perfect place to write is here. If I am in the zone, I can write on planes, trains, automobiles, in the middle of a parking lot. I have a little Greek deli near my office in Fairfax. I go there sometimes. There's 80 people sitting around me, or it used to be before COVID, eating and drinking and talking, and I have my little table at the back, and I've written some of my best stuff there. I feel like I'm in this cocoon because I'm in the zone. And it's funny about that little deli, because I went there one time, and I went up to the cash register, and I ordered my stuff, and my table, somebody was at my table. It's not really my table, folks, you know, but I feel like it's my table. And I thought, I'll just slow walk the order, and they'll be done, and then I'll go get my table. And so that's what happened, you know, I got my stuff, but then somebody went over and got the table, you know, after the other guy left. I was like, oh, well, I'll take it back to the office. So I'm paying for my order, and somebody taps me on the shoulder, and I turn, and it's the guy who was at the table. And he said, Mr. Baldacci, your desk is ready. He worked there, and he bussed the table so I could go work at my table. And I went home and I told my wife that, and expecting her to go, oh, that's great. She looked at me, she's like, oh my God, I've told you over and over, you go there way too much.
I'm curious, when you say that there are times where you're zoning out, you ever do that with your wife?
Let me just tell you, I so married above my pay grade, let me just say that. I will be at parties, and somebody will, and I'll be sitting in the corner with like a drink in my hand, like doing one of these. And somebody will come over to my wife, and they were like, Michelle, has David had a stroke? Because he's not looking well. And she's like, you know, she's partying, she looked over, he's finishing a chapter, give him 5 minutes, he'll be back. So anyway, so that's how it works for my wife and I. And I'll tell you another quick wife story. So we got a place in Florida a number of years ago, and we bought a car for down there. It wasn't ready to be delivered, so when it was, she was there and I wasn't. And the guy, the salesman, doing all the paperwork and she's signing all the documents, he was a big fan of mine. So he was going on and on ad nauseum about David to my wife. And then he made the most critical error, because then he asked her, so what do you do? So my wife, you know, she calmly just finishes signing everything, and she puts the pen down, and she said, what do I do? And he said, yeah, what do you do? And she said, everything else. It is so true.
And by the way, want to let everyone know, remind everyone that in about 15 minutes, you can ask questions of David. Microphones here to the left and right. Just walk up to the microphone. We have a limited amount of time, like 15 minutes or so, to ask questions. So if you do want to ask a question, just step right up to the microphone and we'll see if David can answer your question. I'm curious also, I mean, I'm delving into your personal life now, but do you ever run any of your ideas by your wife or a family member or friends and say, what do you think of that?
I've never run ideas past them about what I want to write about, because that's sort of the most personal part of the whole process, you know, where you get your ideas and how you want to craft those ideas. My wife, for the longest time, and I'll tell another story myself, the longest time she would read all the manuscripts beforehand, give me input, really good input. But she's also a voracious reader. She reads everybody. She reads like 3 books a week. I mean, just really a lot. And she loves it and enjoys it. And she would come up to me and say, oh, this book was great and terrific and all that. And of course, I'd give her a first draft. And there's a lot of problems and issues, you know. And me, the man, I'm kind of getting ticked off that she loves all these other books that are finished books, and I'm giving her drafts. So I stopped giving her drafts for a while, and I would just give her the finished books. It was like apples to apples, right? And then it bothered her. And I was like, I'm just the biggest jerk in the world. This is ridiculous. You know, she was such a vital part of this whole process. And my own ego got in the way. And I don't mind telling you that, because, you know, it happens to everybody. My own ego got in the way, and I cut her off from this really cool relationship we had with the books. So like the last six books, you know, I've given her the first draft. I said, have way, rip it apart, you know, tell me what you think. And you know what? It's really worked well. You know, she's got great opinions and stuff and things that, you know, even when I'm writing the book and I think I know everything that's going on in it and where things should be and I've answered every question, you know, she'll come and hit me with some zingers that shows me that other opinions are really valuable and you should listen to them. That should not just stop with books, folks. That's all about life.
Have you used some of her suggestions to make changes?
I have, because, you know, a lot of her suggestions come about points of view, perceptions of people, where I've gone too far with someone, you know, too extreme on something, and I'm beating people over the head with a point, and she's like, you don't need to do that. I also learned that from screenplay writing. I adapted one of my own novels for a feature film, Wish You Well, and we had Ellen Burstyn was one of the lead actors, Academy Award winner, wonderful, wonderful at all levels. And I remember we had to, if you think writing a script and then you hand it off to the director and you're done, not at all. I was rewriting the script all the way through. And the way movies are done, every time you write a different page or make a change to a script, it has to be on different colored paper. So that all units in the film, from the lighting guys to the electrical guys to the gaffers, the costumers, everybody, they working on the newest script. So at the end of the entire process and the film was done, they call them rainbow scripts because you open it up and all the pages are different colors. You know, you have to go from white to brown to yellow to green to chartreuse. You never would get to cherry, right? Well, I blew right through cherry, you know, on that script. So I'm writing this, I'm rewriting this page of dialogue for Ellen Burstyn. I'm in the middle of a farm in Southwest Virginia. I've got roosters and chickens all over my butt. I'm at this little table on the outside with cows and chickens and roosters, and I'm writing this scene, and she's waiting in front of the camera in full costume to deliver these new lines of dialogue. Talk about a little bit of pressure. And as I'm writing it, you know, I'm giving her line after line after line, and I'm like, no, I don't have to do this. I've got one of the greatest actors of all time. I'll give her one or two lines of dialogue and then I'll let Ellen Burstyn do what Ellen Burstyn does. She can act and emote, and with an expression, she can deliver four lines of dialogue that I was planning to give her to say. And so oftentimes what my wife does really well is, you know, you've made the point, pull it back, don't pound people on the head about it, and let them do what they do.
What's the difference between writing a screenplay and writing a book?
Where do I begin? Writing a book, you're the master and commander. So at the end of the day, what you want to have in the book stays in the book. As the writer, you're like way down on the pole. The director's at the top. And I remember Bill Goldman, William Goldman, wrote the screenplay for Absolute Power. He's won two Academy Awards, All the President's Men, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. He wrote Princess Bride, the book and the movie, the Marathon Man. If you're scared of the dentist, do not read the Marathon Man. And we talked a lot about that, and I remember when he called me up one time and said, because in the book, the character played by Clint Eastwood is killed about halfway through in Absolute Power. Well, back then, Clint Eastwood did not die in any of his movies, right? Even in like you know, Pale Rider, he came back as a ghost and kicked everybody's ass. I mean, it was just, so that was Eastwood. He didn't die in a movie, I think, until like Gran Torino when he got machine gunned down. So back then, William Goldman's marching orders were to find a way to keep Clint Eastwood alive because Clint was the hero and the young lawyer that was in the book wasn't even in the movie. So I remember Goldman called me up one night, late at night, I think he'd had a few drinks, and he said, I can't figure out how to keep the son of a bitch alive. He said, do you want to have a shot at it? I said, Bill, I spent 3 years writing the book killing him. No, I don't want to have a shot at it. So they had to bring in Terry Gilroy as a polished scriptwriter to figure out a way to keep Eastwood alive. So the gist of it is that you don't control anything, you know, on a script. And if the director wants something to go, it goes. And if they want something in, if you won't write it, then they'll find somebody else who will.
Yeah. Just step back for a moment. We just heard someone say, you have to find a way to keep Eastwood alive. Okay, that's not something you hear in everyday conversation like Lancaster County. That's for sure. You know, I personally, and I think most people I've talked to, when a book, a film is adapted from a book, the book is more satisfying than the film. The books that you've written that have been adapted to film, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, they are. As someone who's adapted and written screenplays, the first thing you have to ask yourself is, what slice of the book are we going to film? Because you can't film the whole thing. I will tell you, if you took a 400-page book and made it into a movie and didn't cut out anything from the book, all the subplots and tangential characters and all that, it would be like a four-hour movie. And people will sit through a four-hour movie, but you have to have two elements in that movie. One, you have to have a young, really beautiful couple falling in love. And second, you have to have a huge ship sinking for a really long time. Other than that, you're out of luck. So even for like Wish You Well, I knew that I was going to have to write a very tight center of that story. And the reason why books are more satisfying is because all the really cool peripheral characters that cut out, all the subplots that made things interesting, they're all gone. You don't have time to do that. If you're spending $1 million a page to film a movie, then you understand that that's high stakes. And I learned as a screenplay writer that every scene, if you're going to write a scene in a movie, it has to have at least two reasons why it's there. One does not cut it. It has to have at least two, three even better. But you have a lot more latitude and flexibility in a novel. I think, you know, one of the best books to movie adaptations I've ever seen, which is really faithful to the book and included a lot of the book in the movie, was To Kill a Mockingbird. And I think that's, people will agree that that movie was really, really good and very faithful to the book. I think that's because the filmmakers involved really understood how significant that work was, and they wanted to make sure they were true to it.
I may be getting off track here, but when you just mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird, there is a lot of controversy around the country right now. Books being banned or taken out of school libraries. First of all, have any of your books been banned? And what are your thoughts on a classic like To Kill a Mockingbird being taken out of a school library?
Yeah, my books have been on challenge lists for years, for bad language, for violence, for viewpoints in them. And, you know, a classic like To Kill a Mockingbird, I'm on the board of the Mark Twain House. My wife and I, 6 years ago, created the Mark Twain American Voice in Literature Award. I'm going to give that out at the end of this month. And Huckleberry Finn has been banned for years and on challenge lists for years because of some of the language it's used. And people I've heard where some states are saying that no book can be taught in a school if it makes anyone uncomfortable. And books are supposed to make you uncomfortable. I mean, they are. They could be pleasurable, and they should be. They could be a joy to read, and they should be. But I equate making people uncomfortable with making people think about things, you know? And if that makes you uncomfortable, then maybe you should think about those things even more. I'm very much an historian. I was a political science major in college, but I minored in history. I know where banned books get us eventually. You know, I know where the drive to ban books and censor writers get to us eventually. Talk about, you know, as a lawyer, I can tell you, it was beaten into our heads, this concept of the slippery slope. You know, it may not sound so bad now, but that slope gets really steep and really slippery. So before it could be, we're going to ban certain books because of this and this. Oh, we're going to ban these books because of that. And then we're going to ban these books because they don't really agree with what we believe in. And then we're going to ban all books because who needs books, you know? As 1984 taught us. So I'm free speech, First Amendment kind of guy. I'm for all the amendments, but the First Amendment is there first for a reason. Because then banning books for me is taking away opportunities for people to see things and to think about things for themselves. So when you take away opportunity for someone, nobody would in this country would say, we need to take away job opportunities from lots of people. Nobody wants that. So why should you take away book opportunities from lots of people?
And I'll remind you that if you have a question for David, it's about time to ask those questions. So just step right up to the microphone. There's one on either side if you'd like to ask a question. Well, let's talk about libraries. I mean, that's why we're here today. Yes. One of the reasons that why we are here today is to benefit libraries and books. Obviously, you make your living as a writer. The written word is very important to you. Not everyone has the same kind of passion for books. And the reason may be is because they can't read or they can't read well. You and your wife, Michelle, established the Wish You Well Foundation that supports family and adult literacy in the U.S. First of all, tell us about the foundation and why literacy?
When I first started out my career as a writer, I went everywhere. You know, I went everywhere because I knew it was important for me to, you know, build my career, build a fan base. I wanted to get out and talk to people about books that I'd written. And so, you know, if you were, you know, a very nice lady in Nebraska who had a four-person book club, yes, we have you. We're talking about your book. I'll be right there. What's for dinner? So get on a plane. I'm in Nebraska, you know. But a lot of the events that sponsored and supported me early on were libraries, friends of the library, literacy organizations. So I get a crash course in the state of literacy in the United States. There are about 200 million adults in the U.S. About 100 million adults in the U.S. read at the two lowest levels of literacy. The first lowest level is pretty much you're illiterate and you can't read at all. The second level is that you're functionally illiterate, meaning that you would have a struggle to read a short grocery list. You would have a struggle to read a prescription on the back of on a drug. They did a study years ago that talked to people who had the same physical ailments, same diagnosis, people who could read at a high level and people who could not. And the people who could not read at a high level had a fatality rate three times that of the people who could read at a high level. And if you dig deeper into the literature on that, it's because, think about it, if you can't really read at a high level, it's difficult to get to places. You can't even read a map. You can't go to a bus stop. And then if you're given prescription medicine to read, it has a label there that tells you everything you're supposed to do about that. And if you can't read at a high level, you take it incorrectly, you don't take it at all, and your outcome is far more severe than someone who can read. To read is the same verb as to think. They are interchangeable. So when we started the Wish You Well Foundation, and you have 100 million adults and a lot of non-adults who can't read at acceptable levels, you sort of institute and say that we're going to have this generational cycle of illiteracy and poverty in this country that you're not going to break out of, because illiteracy and poverty go hand in hand. If you're illiterate, you're not going to probably be self-sustaining. You're not going to have a good job. Your marketing skills are going to be low, particularly in information age these days, right? So that's why we started the Wish You Well Foundation. We funded literacy programs in all 50 states and counting. We team with Feeding America, which runs all the nation's food banks, so that I collect books in my book tour, and we send those off to food banks around the country. So people going in seeking food assistance, most of those people are literacy challenged. They can bring home books to their home. I have never seen a bad result from a book being in a home. I have seen many, many bad results from no books being in a home. And let me tell you, there are millions of homes across this country that have never had a book cross the threshold of that place. So to be a citizen, in a functioning citizen in a free and open democracy, requires something of its citizenry. It requires people to be able to read and to understand the issues, process significant things, and make decisions, and then go to the polls and vote based on their own thoughts and their own opinions, not what people are telling them to think. And let me tell you, I worked in Washington, D.C. for a long time. There are lots of really highly educated, well-compensated people whose only job it is to convince you what you should think and how you should vote. And it is a huge business there. I would much rather people get there on their own. And if you can't get there unless your reading levels are really high. I'm a writer today because I was a library rat. You know, my parents took my brother and sister and I to the library every week, and I checked out four more books than I ever was supposed to, because I had these secret deals with the librarians. You know, they knew I would read all the books and I would bring them back. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia in the 60s and 70s in a heavily segregated society. And I have a lot of people that I grew up with back then whose lives and perspectives and opinions on the world were formed in cement during that time and have never deviated since. I could have been one of them. What saved me were books. Even though I never traveled outside of Richmond, Virginia as a child, we didn't have the ability to do that. I saw the world through books. So I saw people who didn't look like me, dress like me, eat like me, pray like me, learn like me, speak like me, but I saw our shared core level of humanity. And I'm empathetic today to everyone because I was a little boy who picked up a book and read about people who didn't look like me, but I got them and I understood them. So that's why I say, the more books we have that people are reading and we become a literate nation, most of our social ills, whether it be social injustice, discrimination, poverty, most of those social ills will go away if we do that one thing. Now, it's a hard thing to do, but if we do that, you would be amazed how much better the world would be.
Let's take some questions, sir. Your first name and where you're from.
First name is John, right here from Lancaster. Thanks for visiting, by the way. Hopefully you have a whoopie pie before you leave. David, my question's kind of two-pronged, and it has to deal in terms of publishing. So knowing what you know now, if you had to do it all over again and start from square one and become a first-time publisher, would you do anything differently? And I'm also kind of curious as far as how you've dealt with the challenges of getting your books sold over the years with less physical bookstores and Amazon now being a major driver as a seller. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You, John. Great. I was in your office, wasn't I? Was I in your office?
No.
Oh, that was somebody else. Okay. It was a nice green room. Whoever's office is, very nice green room. I didn't know really anything about, you know, how to find an agent. All I knew back then was I needed an agent, because back then self-publishing meant selling it out of your trunk of your car. There was no Amazon, no other platforms back there. But what I knew, did know, that I needed an agent who would understand a first-time writer. So what I did, I tried to be creative in finding an agent as I was in writing my books. So every time I heard about a first-time novelist who had hit it big, had a big deal, got an agent, got it published, I would go to the bookstore and I would look in the acknowledgments. Because that's the acknowledgement where people, the author thanks, you know, thank you for this, thank you for that. And you always thank your agent. I mean, you just do. So I got a list of agents from that process, about 6 or 7 agents. And from there, I knew that when I sent up the manuscript, I planned to send the whole manuscript. People these days now will send sample chapters. I didn't know that. So I wrote a very short query letter because thinking it through, I thought, okay, I'm going to say 2 things in this query letter. And I'm going to make it really short. They don't care about the letter. They care about the manuscript. So I gave them one line of information about me. I'm David Ball Dodge. I'm a trial lawyer in Washington, D.C. This book is about the U.S. president, a burglar, a cover-up, and a national scandal. Third sentence, I guarantee if you read the first page of this book, you will not put it down until you read the last page. Yours truly, me. And I did that for 2 reasons. One, I felt like I needed to have confidence in my material if I expected them to have confidence in my material eventually. And 2, psychologically, I knew that half of them would read it just to prove me wrong. So they could write me and say, no, you actually suck, okay? So I would have, you know, I would have probably changed and still written a very short query letter, but I would have had maybe sample chapters, not the entire manuscript. So I remember sending it up to, you know, 7 agents. 6 of them got back to me immediately, wanted to be my agent. And one agent declined. So I went up and interviewed these agents in New York while I was practicing law in Washington. Again, nobody at my law firm knew I was even writing all those years. So I went up and interviewed, and the agent I have today has been my agent forever, one of my best friends. He said, look, I know you're interviewing a bunch of agents. He said, I can sell this book. He said, you know, an animal, a monkey could sell this book. You know, that's not a problem. All I want to know is, do you have more books inside of you? Because I don't represent books, I represent careers. And he was the only one who told me that. So I went with him, and, you know, the rest is kind of history. It's worked out really well for both of us. I do remember meeting the agent who declined me like 5 or 6 years later at a big book event. And he came over to me and he said, first of all, congratulations on your success. Second of all, I tell everyone, you are the biggest mistake I ever made in my whole life. And quite frankly, I said to him, no, I'm not, because at that point in time, you didn't react to the material and you went with your gut. So you wouldn't have been a good agent for it because you obviously didn't believe in the material. So I think it was a good decision for you. He goes, yeah, thanks for trying to make me feel better. But so with the Amazons of the world and all that, it's almost, it's kind of like a pendulum. You know, when I first got into the business, it was all hardcover books, mass markets. I would sell 3-4 million copies of a mass market with every book. Now there's almost no mass market left. Then you have sort of the big, I call them prime time mass markets, a little bit bigger. Then trade books, which I was the first thriller writer to try trade books. You know, usually it's for like literary fiction and other things like that, and they sold really well. And then ebooks came along and like exploded. And then all of a sudden you're selling more ebooks than you were selling hardcover books. Throughout it all, you know, I never got too high or never got too low. I was like, yeah, I'm selling a lot of ebooks now and not as many print books, but at some point those iPads are gonna fill up, the Nooks are gonna fill up, the Kindle's gonna fill up. You got 9,000 books you bought, and you're gonna take you a little while to read them all. And now hardcover books have come back, print books have come back strong again, and the ebooks have leveled off. Where that goes from here, I don't know. You know, 10 years from now, you may just push a button here and a book will appear in your brain and it'll be all there. I don't know, I can't guesstimate. What I will tell you is that human beings, our entire existence is built on stories. You know, it's how we used to do our histories, oral histories, or the way histories used to be handed down before the written word came along and you had books to chronicle it. So we will never be without that. People will always want something to read. They will always want to jump into someone else's imagination because that's who we are as human beings. I don't think that will ever go away. I don't really care how it's delivered. I don't care if you read it on an ebook. I don't care if you listen to it on the audio. I don't care if you hold a real book in your hand and read it. I just want you to read, you know, and not just my stuff. I want you to read lots of other things. And I think that, you know, the more we do that, the better off we'll be.
Pressing the button, maybe another book. Maybe a science fiction book, but there's an idea right there for someone. Let me go over to this side. Sir, your first name, where you're from?
My name's Jim. I'm from Lebanon, Pennsylvania, currently in the process of moving to nearby Myers Town.
Oh, okay.
And
it's a big move.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. First time I've ever moved in 74 years, so.
Wow.
First of all, Mr. Lamar, I would like to congratulate you on all your awards. I really think you have the greatest talk show program out there, and I've called your show many, many times.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Baldacci, it's a pleasure to be here and have you here. Thank you so much for coming. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you. And I just wanted to tell you that I read many things. I read ancient history. I read many subjects, including current day authors. I enjoy them all. I've read many. But in my own opinion, I think you are certainly the most outstanding of the present day authors.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You are
very kind.
You are the Beethoven of the present day authors. And one of my, and it's hard to pick a favorite, but one of my very favorite books that I have read of yours is The Winner. And I was so impressed by that. All the minute little detail from there's no waste basket in the office to the secretary's fingernails are too long to type and the plot twists and going out of the country and coming back. And I mean, it just blew me away. I thought, I could never come up with all this detail, all this interesting plot. And while you've discussed briefly before about outlines or no outlines, I thought, when you get an inspiration for something like that, how do you go about putting all that detail, all that logic, all that order, making it so believable, and all these plot twists? Do you have most of it conceived before you write, or does a lot of it come to you while you're writing? And do you go back and change things earlier to conform with a new idea? Or if you would expound upon that, I would greatly appreciate it. And again, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Great questions.
That is a great question.
Yeah, terrific questions. And that was not a paid endorsement, by the way. It was just a very lovely comment, and I appreciate it very much. The winner, I wrote The Winner because I don't like lotteries. You know, lotteries are sort of like a regressive tax on people who can't afford to do it. The most lucrative lottery stand or outlet, at least on the East Coast that I know of, is in one of the most impoverished areas. And you never really see a lot of lottery business in the really, you know, upscale areas because people know it's just the odds are ridiculous. And in law school, I wrote a paper about lotteries. Way back when lotteries were all banned in the 19th century because they were all corrupt. And then eventually, in the mid-20th century, people started having a lot. New Hampshire, I think, was one of the first to have a lottery in Connecticut and all that. But back then, truth in advertising laws didn't apply to state governments. So in lottery ads way back then, they could say, you know, play the New Hampshire lottery. Everybody wins, you know? They could say stuff like, so I wrote a paper saying this, they should be held to the same standards as like a Burger King. And, you know, Burger King has a lottery, they have to tell you the odds and all that stuff, like any other private enterprise. So I wrote that paper. Then I had this idea for this guy, Jackson, who had figured out how a way to fix the United States National Lottery. I didn't want to do it the usual way, to your point. How can somebody fix this thing without a huge conspiracy? So I went and looked at lottery machines, you know, how they actually are used, the little balls and the tube they're supposed to adhere to. That's a very important point, adhere to. So I figured out a way how I could scientifically fix the lottery. And then Jackson's character, the master of disguise. My job as a writer is to think about and show you all the details that you never think about in your life. As you walk through life, you don't think about the empty waste basket or the length of the secretary's nails or the concrete. You don't think about that stuff. But it's my job to pull those interesting details out. There was a movie years ago, The Usual Suspects. At the very end of that movie, you remember the end of that movie where Kevin Spacey's character is sitting there telling this load of crap to the lawyer or to the police officer throughout the entire movie, all the stuff he described. And the police officer sits down at his desk. And he's looking at the cup on his desk and the thing on the wall, and now he realized that that guy, Kevin Spacey, had built his whole story out of stuff in his office. And the guy had been in that office for, 20 years? He'd never even noticed really any of this stuff, but Kevin Spacey walked in and built an entire story out of details that were literally staring that police officer in his face for most of his life. So that's my job, to take all the stuff you look at every day but don't think about, and sort of stick it in your face and say, this is important. You need to think about this. Now, one of the things that came out of that book was that like 3 years later, I got a call in my office from La Repubblica, which is Rome's largest daily newspaper. And they said, Mr. Baldacci, have you been following the Italian national lottery scandal? I said, why no? I must have missed that. He said, well, someone figured out how to fix the Italian National Lottery, and they did it in a way that's strikingly similar to the one you came up with in the winter. Would you like to comment on that, sir? So I was like, whoa. I said, okay, I have two comments. First of all, one, that is bad. That is very, very bad. I would admonish anyone, do not go out and fix the lottery. That's a felony. You could go to prison for that. My second comment, that's like the coolest thing I've ever heard in my whole life. That's like validation. But then I tell people, do not go and buy the winner and read it and try to fix the lottery. You'll go to prison and feel bad, and I'll feel bad that you're in prison. So don't do that.
We actually, Pennsylvania had the biggest American lottery scandal in history here back in 1980. A guy injected paint. Into the balls. So
I read about that. Yeah. That was one of the ones in the queue for me when I was working on the winner, because I knew about the Pennsylvania lottery scandal on the paint. So mine's a little better.
Yeah, because that guy did go to jail for a long time. Unfortunately, we're only going to have time for one more question. Sir, your name, where you're from?
Yes, my name is Ephraim. I'm from Walton-on-Thames, just outside of Surrey. You're one of three authors that I attribute to molding my way of writing. I've published four books, and I guess I have a ton of questions, but the one I'll go with is, you talked a lot about promotion, and when it comes to promotion, what's the best advice you could give a young author, especially independent authors, as far as the best way to promote. And really, the biggest problem I have is a lot of people read my books. I have a hard time getting them to leave reviews.
Right.
You know, so that's really just the best advice you could give on that.
It's a really great question, and I know the frustration because, you know, I had a publishing house behind me and promotions and all that, but after a while that goes away. So this is about, I guess I would answer this about it. You have to take control of your own career. And I'm not saying be a micromanager, but I'm just saying that you have to understand the ins and outs, the publishing industry. It's a microsystem. It's an ecosystem. So there are components to it. You have the writers who write the books. You have the publishers who publish the books. You have the bookstores who sell the books in all sorts of formats. And then you have readers like all of you. And you have to find a way that addresses all of those needs. And the way I would do it is, okay, well, if I'm in a, and I did this for years, if I'm in a place, a town, and I go to all the bookstores in that town, and I walk in, if they have some of my books, I go up and I ask them, would you like me to sign your stock for you? And not only do they do that, early on I did have to show ID, by the way. They were like, no, you're not gonna write in the books, are you crazy? No, it's me. It's like, let me see that. Do you have another form of ID other than the driver's license? But it wasn't just signing the books, it was talking to the booksellers. I have to tell you that as many books as my first book sold, independent booksellers that I had actually visited and talked with and spent time with and got to know, I had one bookseller in just one store who had ordered 3 copies of my book initially, ended up selling 1,500 copies of Absolute Power out of that one bookstore. Because I walked in, I signed the 3 copies she had, I spent time with her, we became friends, and she really believed in me and I believed in her. It's a very sort of, you know, I won't say transactional, but if somebody else knows that you have their back and you're trying to help them, they will bend over backwards trying to help you. And I would also go, you know, out and I would talk to people in different communities. You know, I can talk about lots of different things. I can talk about my law career. I can talk about the books that I write. I'd love to come and talk to you. You know, I would go and we would look at communities, you know, the sort of programs they would have. And I would offer to come out and talk to people. One, because I like talking to people. I like meeting people and just hearing their points of view on lots of different things too. So that's how you slowly build out a support base. And I'm not saying that it's easy, but if you do it consistently enough, I was surprised the effect that it had on my career too. But you have to balance it, and you know this as well. You have to balance it with you need to have time to write the books. You know, I would jokingly, half jokingly tell people, you know, why can't you come? Can you come to this one? Whenever I have a book come out, the publisher sends a spreadsheet with all these places they want me to come. And they have, literally, they say, this is how many people are going to be there. This is how many books are going to be sold. And we're going to do all this promotion. And it's like this competition, like, you know, 60 or 70 different places. And I can only pick, you know, a few. But I tell people, look, if I went to all those places, I'd have no time to write the books. And you wouldn't want me to hear me speak about anything, you know, because that's what I do. You know, you have to balance that. But those are some of the methods that I used in my career.
Well, I hate to wrap this up, but because this has just been so fascinating and it's such a great morning with David Baldacci, but we are limited for time. David, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.